Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about how a plant-based diet is the best thing one can do for the environment and the best for your health.
So if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about the environment, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Michael Weberman and Michelle Rojas. Michael's the strategic director, and Michelle is the managing director of a new organization called Better Eating International. That's a little later on the program, but first some news.
From One Green Planet. The plant-based food sector is booming, and eating plant-based has been described as the fastest-growing lifestyle movement. According to some estimates, the plant-based meat market is set to reach $5.2 billion by 2020 and can make up to one-third of the market by 2050. This move away from meat is largely due to consumers' rising concerns about animal welfare, personal health, and sustainability. Food giant Nestle seems to understand this shift in food because they recently bought Sweet Earth Natural Foods, a California-based company known for vegan meals and snacks made from plant-based proteins. Paul Grimwood, Nestle CEO and chairman, said in a statement that half of Nestle's consumers are seeking more plant-based foods in their diet, and 40% are open to reducing their traditional meat consumption. Indeed, meat consumption in the U.S. has been in steady decline over the past decades, driven by reasons ranging from health, concerns over animal welfare, to environmental factors. Recent studies estimate that nearly one-third of Americans, or roughly 100 million people, are consciously choosing to keep meat off their plates more often. And millennials are transforming the American consumer marketplace by demanding fresh, healthy, and more plant-based food options. Although Nestle may not have the best track record when it comes to sustainability, especially considering their penchant for draining water from drought-stricken regions and bottling it for sale, we hope that with this acquisition of Sweet Earth Foods, they are changing from the inside out. Nestle said in a statement that they hope this acquisition will help them build out their plant-based food options and give the company a foot in the door to the plant-based food sphere. This is a great move, considering a number of other large food conglomerates have made similar acquisitions recently. For example, Canadian meat processor Maple Leaf Foods recently acquired Lightlife Foods, a producer of plant-based products such as tempeh, vegan sausages, and burgers. Tyson Foods, Inc., the world's largest meat producer, has a 5% ownership stake in the plant-based protein producer Beyond Meat. Some may be hesitant to embrace these huge companies getting involved in the plant-based sector, but we are reaching a time when the question of how we are going to feed a growing population that is set to reach 9 billion by 2050 cannot be ignored. Demand for protein in the developed and developing world is at an all-time high, with the average person in the U.S. consuming 103 grams per day, around double the actual recommended amount. The animal agriculture system already covers 45% of the world's landmass, uses a majority of finite freshwater resources, and is responsible for rampant air and water pollution. Not to mention is the largest singular source of global greenhouse gas emissions. Even with all the resources that this industry uses, nearly 1 billion people still go hungry. The fact is, we need companies like Nestle to get involved in shifting our broken food system away from animal agriculture and towards a more sustainable one centered around plant-based proteins instead. Thanks to companies like Sweet Earth Foods and investors that are willing to bet on sustainable innovations in the food space, we are seeing the future of food being formed here and now. Sweet Earth Foods will continue to be led by its current owners, who are driven to create products that are environmentally friendly and nutritious.
The National Wild Horse Summit was held behind closed doors in Salt Lake City, Utah last month. U.S. Representative Rob Bishop of Utah told the Wild Horse Summit that wild horse advocates care more about fundraising than the animals. But, of course, there were no horse advocates there to defend themselves because they were not invited to attend. Then Representative Bishop tried to make a joke that some people believe that every horse is Seabiscuit, while others think every horse should be Seabrisket. Not very funny. And also not funny that Representative Bishop and U.S. Representative Chris Stewart of Utah advanced their agenda of slaughtering wild horses so that federally subsidized cattle and sheep ranchers can steal more land from wild horses and other wildlife. Priscilla Farrell, president of Friends of Animals, said, "Instead of pro-slaughter efforts in Congress regarding wild horses, we need legislation that would allow wild horses to be returned to lands where they once roamed and that would remove cattle and sheep from wild horse management areas." Today, wild horses face increasingly commercialized Western public lands. Upwards of 2 million cattle graze on public lands, and the government has authorized thousands of oil, gas, and mineral extraction projects on federal lands. The result is a crisis for the wild horses and the environment. These commercial activities have reduced the amount of habitat left for wild horses and other wildlife. Since the passage of the Wild Horse and Burro Act of 1971, wild horses have lost an additional 41% of their habitat. Supporters of wild horse slaughter argue that the Bureau of Land Management's wild horse program is costing the nation too much money. They argue that culling the herd makes the most economic sense. But the fiscal concerns with the wild horse program are overblown compared to the other ways the government wastes our tax dollars. The Wild Horse and Burro Act was passed in 1971, and their protection was a responsibility given to the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, the agency which also grants grazing rights on public land to cattle ranchers. The Bureau has abandoned their duty to protect wild horses in deference to cattle ranchers. The BLM captures wild horses and places them in holding facilities because cattle ranchers say the wild horses of the western states are consuming all the forage on public lands. There are only a few thousand horses on public lands compared to 2 million cattle. Who's really eating all the forage? The Bureau of Land Management has about 30,000 wild horses in their holding pens, more horses than are left in the western states in the wild. And although the BLM was supposed to protect the horses, they now think it's necessary to destroy them. Our nation's wild heritage has been usurped by the hunger for cheap hamburger. Oil, gas, and mineral development and cattle ranching can't continue to be unrestrained and to be allowed to perform uncontrolled damage to the environment and the wild animals of our country. Better Eating International is a new nonprofit organization dedicated to inspiring compassion and sparing animals from miserable lives and cruel deaths through personalized educational videos. Their goal is to help create a future where animals are valued as unique individuals and no longer exploited for human gain. Today we'll be talking with Michael Weberman, Strategic Director, and Michelle Rojas, Managing Director of Better Eating International. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Michael Weberman and Michelle Rojas. Thanks for being with us on the show, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
You know, we like to start off by asking our guests what turned them vegan in the first place. Michael, you want to go first with your story?
Sure, yeah, I'd love to. I think for me, probably my path to vegetarianism was more interesting and the path to veganism was kind of the natural extension. But
yeah.
So for me, I was quite young. I was 14 years old, I think, my freshman year of high school, and I was sitting in my French class, and we learned one day how to say the names of farmed animals in French and how to make their noises in French. So like pigs go groin groin instead of oink oink. And I thought that was pretty neat. And then we learned moments later how to say all the cuts of meat in French. And I had just never really thought about farmed animals and cuts of meat in the same sentence before. Like, obviously I knew that farmed animals created meat. I wasn't an idiot, but I just never thought about it. And something about like that child, kind of child-eyed wonder of learning a new language, I think made it almost as if I had been a 4-year-old learning English for the first time in my native language. Had my mom told me at age 4, oh, this is this cute pig, he goes oink, and that's where our bacon comes from, I think if she had told me all of that at a young age, I would have been quite mortified. And I became quite mortified, and I had this really visceral reaction where I raised my hand and I asked if there was going to be a lesson for learning the name for human cuts of meat. And I got sent to the counselor's office. They put me on like a self-harm watch or something like that. And I was like laying in bed that night, and I realized that I was really that came from a place of harm. That I, you know, while I what I said was rude, what I meant was actually that I was deeply disturbed by thinking about animals this way. I basically just went vegetarian overnight. I'd never met a vegetarian. I think Lisa Simpson was my only prior exposure to vegetarianism. But I just decided, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. No one believed me. None of my friends believed me because I was on the water polo team and I ate a lot of chicken meat all the time and whatnot. No one thought it was not going to stick, and it totally stuck. And then as I got into anti-war activism and environmental activism and kind of made a broader connection between everything, you know, the ecosystems and you know, nonviolence and everything, I just realized that veganism was the only possible natural extension of that. And so that was more of just a slow dropping process from there, you know, started eating less eggs, eating less milk, and then one day said, all right, it's my last time, I'm ready to make the plunge.
Nice. Well, I think, Michael, you may be the only person who's been converted to vegetarianism by a French class. Michelle, how about you? What brought you on your path to veganism or the world of animal protection?
My story was quite different. I was 35 years old. I just had my fourth child. And then I remember it was a Sunday evening, and I went to get groceries. I stocked up on everything as usual, which for our family meant a ton of cheese, lots of yogurt. And, you know, going from there. And when I got back home, my husband was watching a documentary. And he said, you got to see it. Sit down. And I sat down and I saw it. I said, well, I think we're going to make some changes. But I'm going to finish everything I just bought because I need to say goodbye to this. And when that shopping was consumed, then that was overnight for us. And it involved getting some cookbooks and figuring out what I was going to cook that people were actually going to eat, and talking to the kids, hey, you guys, we're going to be seeing some different things at the table. And I didn't even have language to talk about it. So it's certainly been a learning curve since then.
I think a lot of people go vegetarian and vegan today because of videos and documentaries. Back 40 years ago when I went vegetarian, there weren't any documentaries. We had something called books that we read, and that converted us.
Yes.
But back
they're in museums now.
Yeah.
And certainly after that, my sort of like what Michael was saying, you know, your consciousness becomes elevated. And I did read books, and it became more than about health. The ethical component came into play. And so that's been the transition, the mindset.
Yeah.
But at the dinner table, our transition was very, very quick.
You know, speaking about films and videos, Better Eating International plans on using video as a method of outreach. Tell us more about your plans for videos.
Yeah, I mean, so we, you know, between all the members on our team, we have a lot of experience creating and promoting, you know, videos that, you know, expose the ills of animal agriculture and try to move people towards, you know, eating fewer animal products, becoming vegans. But we just realized after all doing it all this time that the recidivism rate is so high and that we're failing often to reach people in ways that really speak to their experiences. And so rather than just creating kind of this one-size-fits-all single best video to expose animal agriculture, we realized it would make a lot more sense to create a lot of shorter videos on various different topics that could be remade in different ways for different angles to speak to people's unique concerns and backgrounds.
Right. And I like the idea of short little spots because attention deficit disorder is rampant in today's culture. So 30-second spots on social media seems like a really good method.
Yeah, and it allows us to be much more responsive in creating content that resonates with people and get better at it through repetitive iteration. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, stop doing what doesn't work.
Right. And it seems, you know, there's a lot of nonprofits out there that are devoted to animal protection, and there doesn't seem to be one that's specifically geared at creating these videos like you all. And, you know, on the campus here at the University of Texas at El Paso, just this morning, you know, I'm walking around and everyone is sitting down. Even people have their tablets and they have their headphones in their ears. And, you know, when I was in college here, everyone was sitting with their books in front of them and out. And I just, I mean, it definitely hit home thinking about the work that you all might do and how quickly people from all different walks of life can get exposed to, you know, what's really happening behind the scenes and how the animal agriculture is, you know, hurting our environment and the animals and our health and contributing to world hunger. So I guess it seems like you all made a very strategic choice in utilizing video as a medium, as a way to reach people from, like I said, all different walks of life.
Yeah, it allows us to find them where they are at. And since many of us are online using different channels, then we can really be more persuasive. Mm-hmm. And connect in a more personal way.
And speaking of recidivism, Michael, that you mentioned, do you all have any particular plans in mind for going after that segment of the population that once was vegetarian or vegan and now has gone astray?
I don't think we have any specific plans to target them as ex-vegetarians and vegans, although I think we'd be open to it. But we do know, fortunately, there's a lot of evidence that former vegetarians and vegans are more likely to become vegetarian or vegan again than a never vegetarian. Uh-huh. So that was something that was gleaned from that big Funalytic study a couple of years ago about the matter. And that was quite good news to me because I've been really concerned about this issue for 6 or 7 years now. And I was worried it was the opposite, that maybe they were the types that now have dug their heels in and became the anti-vegetarians. But the evidence seems to show that ex-vegetarians and ex-vegans do eat less meat than never vegetarians and never vegans, and about half of them are interested in returning. And so I think, I don't know that we would actively target them for that, but I do think that we could be pretty sure we're going to catch a lot more ex-vegetarians and vegans with any persuasive video that we create. And I think the trick is really going to be creating such good support resources that the desire to go back is going to be a lot lower. You know, if we're helping people stock their pantries and their fridges based on the foods that are actually relevant to their cultures and the way they grew up and relevant to their income levels and relative to their living situation, if they're living in a dorm versus living with their parents versus starting their own family, you know, anything like that. So I think the main thing is going to be preventing the recidivism in the first place,
right?
Because we're not just offering this one-size-fits-all package of meal plans and whatnot.
You know, I think one of the main reasons vegetarians and vegans might fail is a lack of community support. And to not have a support network can be pretty damaging. But today, with social media, you know, you can have a lot more vegan and vegetarian friends. I had none when I first went. But now, you know, all my friends are vegan and vegetarians, and I've tried to push the others out of my life.
And you all, you know, the plan is to do, from what I saw in your Kickstarter campaign, is to do why videos and how videos. And I think you talked a little bit about the how videos. I thought one of the things we do here at the Vegetarian Society of El Paso is do outreach at health fairs and things like that. And people are often surprised that there are fast food options. And so I was excited to see that you all are thinking about tackling videos on, you know, how to eat when you go to a fast food restaurant, just because of, you know, our lifestyles nowadays and how everyone's on the run and, you know, you're trying to eat and drive and send text messages and emails and go to your next meeting. And so I was really excited that you all were considering that option because it really removes one impediment for people to transition over.
You said that beautifully. And we know that just when we started this conversation asking about how we became vegan, even when you have a thought, it's hard to implement for any number of reasons. And we will try to address those reasons
through the education pieces. For somebody, it might be eating out. For somebody, it might be how to cook and stay within budget if you cannot afford the fancy replacement meats. For somebody else, it might be, how do I tell my parents what is Thanksgiving going to look like, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And we want to be very empathetic in creating content that truly reflects the preoccupations that people have around making such a fundamental change, because it's not just diet. It has a huge social component as well. And that can't be minimized. If you have support, like you said, if you have a network, if what you're doing fits in the larger social scale, you're much more likely to be able to make long-term change than if you don't.
I love the idea of a video for how to tell your parents. I could. I think that's a hard conversation for many people to have.
Vegans out of the closet.
That's right. And I guess one of the things I was reading too on your Kickstarter campaign was talking just briefly about how the ethical issue of eating meat. And does it seem to you all that really that's the main key to get to people for their motivation to get them to stay in veganism?
Yes, I think stay is the right word. I mean, I think that obviously any angle can be used to get someone's interest piqued. But ultimately, you know, there's two reasons I think that we need to infuse the ethics in pretty high. One of them is that, like you said, people, I mean, the evidence seems to be, and it's admittedly, it's not crystal clear evidence. It's a lot of weak evidence. So multiple points of relatively weak evidence have it kind of summed to create somewhat strong evidence that people are more likely to stick with the vegetarian or vegan diet when they have an ethical drive too, because that can't be traded in the way that other things can be traded. You know, you can trade environmental decisions. You can say, I'll drive less this week so I can have this burger. Or you can trade your health. You can say, oh, I'll eat this piece of, you know, this piece of cheese pizza this week and do an extra 20 minutes of running or whatever. You know, you can trade those. But you really can't. It's a lot harder to trade ethics. And so it seems to be that people that believe it's wrong to eat meat don't eat meat, whereas people that believe it's wrong to eat as much meat don't eat as much meat, which is better, but it's not the same, you know? And then the other component is that we're not just doing this to promote it's not just about a diet. You know, we are trying to elevate the status of animals and to build a world in which it's going to be seen as abhorrent to raise and kill animals for food, not just by the people individually choosing not to eat them, but by society at large. You know, similar to the way that cigarette smoking became kind of a socially shunned act in the last, you know, few decades, and some people obviously still choose to smoke cigarettes, but in general, it's not something. Again, the tobacco industry is seen as a bad actor, and cigarette smoking is recognized as a thing that some of us still do, but is not an ideal act. And I think that's where we want to get animal ag in the coming years, is to a place where even people that still choose to eat some meat recognize that animal agriculture is against our values, is a thing that we don't believe really should exist, and that big ag is seen kind of like big tobacco. And I think the way to do that is to make it an ethical issue more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. And I think we've really been moving in that direction for a number of years, slowly, but hopefully you'll speed things up.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it's been, I mean, clearly the attitudes about these issues have changed drastically in the last few years. And, you know, we obviously want to work to both change the behaviors to reflect those attitude changes and then also use the changed behavior to spread the attitude changes.
For us in the Desert Southwest, it's a bilingual culture, oftentimes multilingual. Do you all have any plans for Spanish resources as well?
We do. And this process of creating videos is resource intensive. So we will certainly start with some audiences and expand from there. But we have a very intentional mission to be multicultural and sensitive to the different needs of different cultural and language groups. And as we create content, We will be speaking with people in the different communities to understand what their needs are, create content specifically for them, and measure results in order to assess if we're doing a good job and find where we can improve before we create the second generation of videos. So we'll make sure it's data-driven, and we're always guided towards effectiveness. It's not about better eating. It's about are we able to connect with the people we intended to connect with effectively, and are they finding it valuable in their journey?
Right, which should hopefully combat part of the criticism of the animal protection movement for not being very diverse. So this is a great opportunity to meet people where they are.
Absolutely, and to recognize that this is a decision that people make in context, not in a vacuum, and they have many other preoccupations related to income, their education, family, social, like we alluded to earlier. So all of those things are important, and what to eat and how to feel and how to connect with other living beings is something that is part of a larger conversation.
And you all were, you know, trying to get all these videos off the ground. You had a Kickstarter campaign. Is that still up?
No, the Kickstarter campaign is finished, and it was successfully funded and
Good.
Matched by a generous foundation.
Great.
So where can our listeners go to learn more then about your work and everything that's going to be coming out?
Yeah, our website is being revamped as we speak. So in a few weeks, we'll have a new website at bettereating.com. And you can find us on any social network with either Better Eating or Better Eating International. So Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Most of them are just Better Eating without the international. But obviously, if you put the international, you'll find us too, because, you know, the searches are optimized. So yeah, Better Eating or Better Eating International on any social media platform and .com with either of those.
Great. We've been talking with Michael Weberman and Michelle Rojas of Better Eating International. Thanks for being with us on the program today, guys.
Thanks so much, Greg and Tom.
It was great. Good luck.
Thank you.
If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's website at vsep.org and go to our calendar of events page to find out all the many events we have planned for this fall.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button. Until next time, I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Greg Lawson. For the Earth, the animals, and for a better humanity, thanks for listening to ACT Radio.